This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers are here, and they're ready and eager to talk all about the biggest news stories of the week. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And also in Edmond this week, visiting from Australia once again, is trumpet writer Callum Wood.
Hi there.
Joining us via Skype from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And joining us via Skype from Jerusalem, Israel, is Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, U.S. President Donald Trump has pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. We spoke about several aspects of this story last week, including about how Europe was rattled and angered by this U.S. decision. And this anger is not going away. It actually seems to be intensifying and deepening, and it's casting some dark shadows on the relationship between America and the nations of Europe. And this points to a major rupture in that transatlantic alliance. To bring us up to speed on the latest developments here, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I feel a bit lazy this week. I think everything I'm covering is basically an intensification of what we talked about last week. But it is an important trend. And in my trumpet brief during the week, I wrote an article on Europe explodes with fury as Iran deal nuked. And I kind of talked a bit more about the anger that's building in Europe, just the anti-Donald Trump kind of commentary that has been coming out of Europe in the wake of this deal. Nobody's kind of saying, okay, well, you know, here are the pros of this deal, here are the cons of this deal, this is why Donald Trump canceled it, here's why we disagree with that. There's no kind of rational reason discussion, but there's a very emotional outburst from a lot of the commentators. Just the basic gist is Donald Trump is a madman, he's an idiot, and he pulled out of this deal for no good reason, and the whole world is going to suffer because of it. But what I want to focus on more this week is the economic fallout from that.
Yes.
Because that's what we've seen a lot of the news come out from over the last week. European leaders got together in Sofia on Wednesday and Thursday. They were meant to be talking about the situation in the Balkans with some instability there. They ended up talking much more about the Iran deal. And they basically, all the European Union voted to keep going, or the heads of the European Commission, they all said, we're going to keep going with the Iran deal, regardless of what America has done. Basically, they could choose between America and Iran. Europe chose Iran. They're going to stick with the deal. And it's really building to this economic confrontation between the two, because America is saying, we're going to put sanctions on American businesses that do business with Iran, but we're going to put sanctions on any business that we can reach anywhere in the world that does business with Iran. And because the dollar underpins the global financial system, that has quite a far reach. You know, even companies that do no business whatsoever with America, they may well still use dollars in their exchange rates, or they may have dealings with American banks. And you know, even the threat of America just saying, we might put sanctions on you, that starts to cause investors to walk away, that causes big problems. And so they can reach well beyond their borders into European companies. And so the European heads of government are looking for ways to combat this now. So they're, for example, looking at doing trade with oil for Iran in euros instead of dollars, where there's a direct exchange, which Iran has been working on this kind of thing with China. You've talked about that going back a few months now, where they've been trying to get away from the dollar. Then the reimposition of sanctions, it's moving, you know, Europe is now getting on board with this moving away with the dollar. They're also looking at bringing in, okay, there's kind of EU legislation on the books that lets them fight back against this. This kind of thing has come up before, where Europe is now trying to find areas they can threaten to put tariffs on America to retaliate in case America starts going after European companies that do business with Iran. So you're looking at them looking at trade war with America, looking at them moving away from the dollar, looking at seeing, well, what can we do just to come away from this US-backed financial system so that they cannot reach into our dealings here? Then you put that together with some of the other stories that you've got going on. So you've got a similar situation now where German companies that are doing business with Russia, especially with a Russian pipeline to Germany, could get caught up in U.S. sanctions. Again, in the same way, so companies based in Germany that have nothing to do with the United States coming under U.S. sanctions because of their involvement with Russia. And then beginning next month, if nothing changes, tariffs are going to go into effect on European steel and European aluminium.
Right.
And then
there's talk of another exemption possibly being given for those tariffs for the European nations. Do you think that that will be given, or do you see that going into effect?
Yeah, I don't know. The European Commission is kind of, they're almost saying we don't want to accept another exemption. We don't want to keep pushing this down the road. We want to deal with this now. You know, kind of put them, you know, like, you know, put up or go home, basically. That's what they're trying to do at the moment. And you're right. And when it comes to these exemptions, even looking at Iran in the short term, there are quite a lot of smart people that are saying Europe's going to fold. You know, the American domination of the financial system is just too powerful. They can't fight this. And even the French president, François Hollande, he said, look, I'm not the CEO of Total, the French oil company. I'm not going to tell them you must do business with Iran. I'm not going to make those decisions for them. We'll look at what we can do to help them avoid sanctions. But at the end of the day, we're not going to start bossing our companies around. So, yeah, I think there is a pretty good chance they'll fold. But I think what is significant is, you know, what we can be sure of is the long term. This is going to get them thinking, well, what can we do in the long term to move away from the dollar, to deprive America of this power?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting just looking at some of the companies, European companies that are already drawing down business in Iran, and seeing how you've got the official ruling class and the bureaucrats in Brussels, as well as the leadership of these nations, that are kind of pushing hard against the United States on this. But then you have the actual businesses themselves in the private sector realizing how big the United States is. And in a way, you might see a fight come up between the private industry and the leadership of the European Union, which could further other trends we've been watching.
Yeah, I think there's lots of interesting directions in the short term, and like, so that's where it's unpredictable. But in the long term, this does tie into a whole bunch of trends like that we've been watching. And the Bible talks about in Revelation 17, Revelation 18, it talks about a coming European superpower, a union of 10 nations that gets together and, you know, that has a lot of power in Europe. But it makes absolutely clear in those scriptures that this is a rich power, that the merchants are heavily involved. The Old Testament calls this power Tyre, after that ancient kind of city-state of Tyre that was famous all around the world as a trading state, as a merchant state. So this coming power has a very strong economic dimension to it. It's going to dominate the global financial system. Revelation 18 says all the nations of the earth are going to be, all the merchants of the earth were made rich by this power. So at the moment, you have a financial system based on the United States, and they're able to use that power even today. And like Brent was saying, it doesn't look like European businesses are going to be able to stand, or there's a good chance they won't be able to stand up to that. But the Bible says what we're going to get is a European-dominated financial system centered around Europe. And so you see this, the Iran deal is, Donald Trump canceling the Iran deal is great. You know, I'm not criticizing him for doing that at all. It, as we've talked about on this show, it was a terrible deal.
Yes.
But you can see how it also ties into this prophecy, where Europe is now going to be much more determined to move away from the financial system, to make a break with the financial system. They're talking even about going towards China, because China is also pro the Iran deal, seeing what they can do to work with China to build an alternative financial system to the United States, because they don't want America having this power anymore. They want that power. And that's exactly what you see prophesied in those scriptures in the Bible, and other scriptures even talk specifically about this trade relationship between Europe and China and Japan. You can read more about this trading power that's coming in Brad McDonald's article from about a year ago, Trade Wars Have Begun, and we can put a link in the show notes to you there. And he goes through some of these prophecies about this economic power building in Europe.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. We will be sure to have a link to Mr. McDonald's article, Trade Wars Have Begun, and also to Richard's article from last week called Europe Explodes with Fury as Iran Deal Nuked. So please check out thetrumpet.com for both of those articles. We spoke there a little bit about President Trump's tariffs and exemptions that have been given to some nations, but one of America's major allies in Asia has not been given these exemptions, and they're now preparing to react very decisively to this. To tell us about this, we'll go to Callum Wood.
That's right. Japan is one of the only major U.S. allies that did not receive exemptions from Trump's tariff decisions. And ever since that decision was made by Washington, Japan has been arguing with the United States to be removed from that tariff list and be granted those exemptions. And up until now, it's all been very underhanded. It's been quiet, behind the scenes, which is somewhat indicative of Japan's policy. They often do move quietly in diplomatic circles like this, trying to push their own decisions and their own will. But all of a sudden, we see Japan has stepped out now, and they are making some bigger moves. Certainly, it's still early days. The announcement only came yesterday, came on Thursday. Japan was considering tariffs on the United States, and these tariffs are expected to be about $409 million, and they're seen as a retaliation against steel and aluminium imports, and those tariffs that have been imposed by Donald Trump. Now, $409 million, it doesn't seem like a whole lot of money, certainly to the United States, but it does show that Japan is now fed up. They're fed up with Donald Trump and certainly not getting their own way. They haven't made enough headway just pleading with him to be removed from this listing. And so now they're taking a stronger position. And what's really interesting about this is that it's the same position that China has been making, the same position that Europe has been making, talking about slapping new tariffs down in retaliation against the United States, against Donald Trump's decision-making. So in March, Donald Trump, he made this decision to slap these import duties of 25% on steel and 10% on aluminium. And it did draw a lot of criticism from countries, and a lot of people talked about this as heightening the risk of a global trade war. And the trumpet certainly has been watching Japan and waiting for a certain shift there, because we do look to a certain number of Bible prophecies that talk about Japan's move away from a relationship with the United States. Now, this is obviously not the complete fulfillment of such a prophecy, but this does play into it in a lot of ways. All of a sudden, we're seeing that Japan and China may be finding a lot more common ground here in opposing America's economic decisions. Japan, for one, obviously does have a strong reliance on America at the moment. It needs America, certainly with China rising on the scene, being a lot more aggressive in the South China Sea and across the region. The Japanese, they need America. They need a strong relationship. But all of a sudden now we see that the Japanese are pushing harder. They want to push harder against Donald Trump and try and get this this tariff removed. Now, some commentators have been talking about it in the sense of, well, it could just be a big bluff. The Japanese may just be trying to get that concession, giving Donald Trump an alternative: either remove us from the tariff list, or we're going to slap these sanctions down on you. Now, that might not make Donald Trump or any of his advisors quiver in their boots, so to speak, yeah. But perhaps it would make them a little bit more concerned that all of a sudden now we are seeing Japan's ideas lining up more with Beijing. That, you know, if Japan was to implement these sanctions, $409 million worth of them, well, all of a sudden they would be joining the camp of the Europeans, joining the camp of the Chinese, and it would be a significant blow to the United States, who has been trying to justify and drum up support for this tariff decision.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us, and also just mention to listeners where they might go to read more about these prophetically significant trends?
Absolutely. Well, there's a fantastic article, and it comes from the July 2016 Trumpet print edition, and it's called The Great Mart of Nations, and it was written by Brad McDonald and Ron Fraser. It was actually updated from the original article appeared back in 2012, and it's a fantastic article for people to go to and to read, because it pulls all the prophecies that talk about what's called the Mart of Nations. and it pulls those prophecies and it puts them together in the context of the world we live in today and what we see forming now. Richard, he spoke there about Europe and how they're coming together and how the Bible does discuss in detail a lot about these merchants. We can read all about them, certainly in Revelation in particular. And we can link those prophecies to an alliance, a mart of nations that's found in Isaiah. And in Isaiah 23 in verse 1, we can see that China is mentioned there by their ancient name, which is Chittim. And then we can tie that in, of course, to other prophecies found elsewhere. Isaiah 23 verse 13 mentions the Chaldeans or the Assyrians. Prophetically, these terms obviously, you know, they refer to the end time European power, a union of church and state that's led by Germany, whose biblical identity is Assyria or Asher. Now, what makes this really interesting is we can jump into other prophecies. Ezekiel 27 verses 1 to 6 uses a lot of maritime terms and it discusses the merchants and enacting trade via sea lanes between Tyrus, again, that was mentioned by Richard earlier on, called the King of the North in Daniel 11, and Germany in association with Chittim or China. And then we can skip down further and we can read in verse 14, and here it talks about the ancient name for Japan and Southeast Asia. And so we can see that they are brought into this mart of nations, which is huge news. That has to be a major shift away from Japan's current policy. We have seen them. I know, Jeremiah, you've spoken at length about Japan's gradual shift away from the United States and Western values, moving closer to alliances with China, with Russia. And so this prophecy here, it discusses Japan in a very tight trade relationship with this power, this in this mart of nations. And so today we see Japan maybe putting on some retaliatory tariffs against the United States. Now, we don't know if they're going to follow through with it, but certainly it does indicate that Japan is taking on a much stronger stance and they're not afraid to let their interests align with some of their key regional enemies, China and the like, if they're going to get these concessions.
Well, thanks very much for that, Callum, and we will be sure to have a link to that article, The Great Mart of Nations. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Well, the trumpet has been carefully watching Iraq since our earliest issues back in the early 1990s. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has said, even as early as 1992, that Iraq would likely soon fall under the control of Iran. And this week, Iraq held elections, the result of which could move Iraq deeper into the Iranian orbit. To tell us about this, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it definitely could. It's interesting, your introduction there, because it is slightly different than how it's been reported in the Western media. The election that took place on Saturday, the group that ended up winning most of the seats, or at least the largest part of the seats in the parliament, is led by a cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr. He might be, or at least Sada, that people might recall that name. If you've been reading The Trumpet for any time, we've been writing about this man for 15 years. He was responsible for a lot of American deaths after the U.S. invaded and toppled the Saddam's regime. And for the longest time, he is a Shiite. He is allied with, or has been allied with Iran in the past. And yet he did promote himself and his party as being pro-Iraqi nationalist, not going to give in to American demands, not going to give in to even Iranian demands for the future. And so the Western media are looking at this now with this man that he doesn't have a majority, his party doesn't have a majority, so he's still going to have to form some type of coalition, obviously. But he did get the most seats, and so people are saying, well, it looks like this might be good for Iraq. It might not be good for America, it might not be good for Iran, but it looks like it could be good for Iraq. And this is because Abadi, who is the current prime minister, his group only garnered about 20-something seats, and they're the third largest party now inside the government. And then the second largest party is the Badr group. They are basically the political arm of the PMU. The PMU were the Shiite militias that basically answer to Iran. So number two in the election is you had an ultra pro-Iranian group came second. The guys that we kind of think are Americans' friends, they came third. And the guys that came first have been trumpeting a pro-Iraqi policy, but in the past have killed Americans, and have this guy has vied that he is going to remove the last American soldier out of Iraq. U.S. has currently 5,000 soldiers there. And so people don't really know. And this is kind of a fluid situation right now where we're not sure exactly how the government's going to form. It hasn't formed yet. You do have on the scene in Baghdad, Iranian Quds Force General Qassem Soleimani. He's there. He's Iranian. He's there in Baghdad trying to work out a coalition that is favorable for Iran. So he's negotiating in Iraq. So it kind of sees, you know, you kind of see how far Iraq has fallen just because of his presence. But we don't know how it's going to work out just yet. However, looking at this going forward, I think you can go back to probably, I'd say, 100 articles on the Trumpet. We've been very decisive and incisive in our analysis, saying that Iran is going to dominate Iraq. And I think we can see that, how that could happen coming out of this election.
So in the Western world, it seems that we often feel that all we have to really do is export democracy abroad, and we'll be able to solve all the problems that the other nations have. This looks like a case where it sort of disproves that democracy is this panacea that can just fix everything that's amiss in the world.
Right. It also, yeah, it does. It shows very much how the people that govern or the people that choose their leaders, they actually might have similar ideals as their leaders. We tend to think if we remove the power or the dictator that we don't like, that somehow an election, the ordinary people are going to pick somebody that has the same ideals that we do, or generally in the West. And in Iraq, this hasn't been the case. In election after election after election, 46% of the people turned up, 54% of Iraq didn't vote. And yet what we have, the people that they elected most, or the person that they elect, most people elected, is somebody that has American blood in his hands, that does believe in getting rid of the U.S. influence, that is a Shiite cleric, that has sought refuge in Iran numerous times, that has extremely strong close ties to Iran. And we also have the first time after this election that we could see an Iraqi parliament that is governed by majority Shiites. This has never happened before. If in a way they could come together where there are only Shiites inside the leading the parliament, they could get the majority if all the groups came together. And this would spell absolute disaster for Iraq's apparently massively sectarian populace, with a lot of Sunnis, a lot of Kurds. They might not even get a voice in this government coming forward. This is the result of democracy inside Iraq. And it looks like, even though you'll see Western commentators saying that, this is great for Iraq, bad for the U.S., but it's bad for Iran too. Well, give it some time. Give it some time. If you want to search for Sadr, S-A-D-R, in the Trumpet search browser, you will find article after article after article for the past 15 years been writing about this character. He is not pro-American. He is pro-Iranian through and through when push comes to shove. And Soleimani's right there on the ground trying to broker some type of deal between these parties. And it wouldn't be surprising in the near future where either Sadr is sidelined or he does reveal his true colors as being part of the Iranian, still being influenced by Iran.
Is there one key article or booklet that you would direct listeners to, just to understand what the ultimate position of Iraq and Iran will be from what we know of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, well, there is going to be an article coming out on this next week by Anthony Chibariwe, one of our writers. He is going to write part of it up. So that would be good to look forward to that. But also people can go ahead and read this article that was written last year, America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory, Aspire Editor-in-Chief. And it goes into great detail of what we've been saying about Iraq falling into the hands of Iran. America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these very important stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story about the slow motion collapse of the once mighty U.S. Merchant Marine fleet. To tell us about this and what the implications are for America's ability to wage war abroad, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this story takes on great significance in the light of what we've already heard this program about tariffs and marts of nations and global trade. Because even though the merchant marines definitely didn't collapse this week, like you said, it's been a slow motion collapse that's taken place over 7 decades. The collapse has been dramatic. The merchant marines, I guess for those who aren't in the know on that topic, it's basically all the trade ships that fly an American flag, American trade ships. And in peacetime, they just trade goods between across oceans. But in war times, they're basically deputized to form the supply lines for America's Navy and battleships. Mm. Most American naval ships, they're designed for fighting. And they, we do have some transport vessels, but not nearly enough to wage a large conflict over on the other side of an ocean. And so it's very vital during World War II. But since World War II, the United States has found it was cheaper for them to actually like subcontract out other nations to be the ones trading goods in peacetime, which means that over 7 decades, America's merchant fleet has declined from 1,288 trading vessels to about 81.
Wow.
So, I mean, just drastic fall. And like I said, in the peacetime, it hasn't, you don't really see the effects of it. Although America's been bitten a couple times in wartime. I think in Vietnam, we had we'd asked a merchant fleet to bring some supply goods that we'd subcontracted out to Mexico, and the Mexicans refused to get involved. And in the first Gulf War in 1991, same thing. They'd asked, not same nation, but asked a number of merchant fleets to supply the U.S. Navy, and at least 13 of them, I guess, more or less rebelled or said that they would not be involved in military resupply lines. Hmm. And so they've got an article in the taskandpurpose.com that we've got in the headline sections of the Trumpet website this week, where it's quoting several defense and former defense officials. They have one retired Navy Rear Admiral who really pointed out that this is a matter of national security. The Navy does not have enough ships to handle a large-scale supply mission on its own. It's relied almost exclusively on the merchant marines in the last several conflicts. And if you have a future conflict, America will find out very quickly that this is a very strategic vulnerability.
So who are these other nations that we've outsourced this incredibly important responsibility to?
I think it's a lot of like Caribbean and Central American nations, Panama and things like that, that we've actually taken American-built ships and basically turned it over to them to fly their flag and try to dodge some tax loopholes that way. But also Japan has enormous merchant marines. China's growing every year. Greece has a huge merchant marine.
So these are all nations that it wouldn't be too difficult to see them deciding not to do America's bidding if tensions ramped up.
Right. And one of the biggest purposes of the U.S. Navy is to protect trade routes, to ensure free trade. And so the types of conflicts you'd imagine that would get involved in are oftentimes going to be over maritime choke points, areas of like straits or channels or capes where trade has to be funneled through. And a lot of those sea gates, you could call them, are now controlled by nations like China or Russia or European nations. And so if those are the things that you're most important to use your Navy to defend, those are also the nations that have the biggest merchant marines using them. And so you could see that they, if it came to a conflict over a sea gate, you could actually be very reliant on the merchant marines of the nation you're fighting with over control of the sea gate.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, actually, this is one of our really keynote prophecies in the Genesis 22 and verse 17. God made an unconditional promise to Abraham that because he had obeyed his laws, that he would make him the father of many nations, and that his descendants would possess the gates of their enemies. And in Herbert Armstrong's landmark book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, he goes through step by step and proving that it's actually the United States and Britain that are the primary. They're descended from Abraham. They're descended from the ancient Israelites. They're the primary inheritors of those promises. If you didn't know anything about world history other than the fact that America controlled all the world's, America and Britain together controlled all the world's sea gates at one point, you could pretty much deduce that these are the descendants of Abraham, the recipients of this prophecy. But in another scripture in Deuteronomy 28, it really talks about how if the end-time Israelites, the Americans, the British, disobey God's laws, that those gates would be taken over by their enemies and used against them to enforce a trade siege. We've already talked about the Mart of Nations earlier in the program, but we know that those Mart of Nations, they will be using these sea gates to enforce an economic embargo against the United States prophetically. And to do that, they have to be able to control those gates militarily. And to defeat the U.S. Navy, that's probably one of the biggest ways, strategic vulnerabilities they could do that, is that America may have some fairly advanced fighting ships, but to supply the crews and the supply lines on those ships, they're reliant on the merchant marines of the very Mart of Nations that's going to be challenging them for those sea gates.
Wow. So in this story about the collapse of the U.S. merchant marine fleet, you can really see how dramatically and how quickly those prophecies could be fulfilled. We'll be sure to have a link to the United States and Britain in prophecy in the show notes, and it really does an excellent job of just proving that those scriptures apply to the United States and Britain today, and just showing how they are rapidly being fulfilled. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about responses in the Middle East to violence on the Gaza border, Germany's view of Italy's new government, China's new aircraft carrier, and a political scandal in the U.S. that may turn out to be bigger than Watergate. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. On Monday, some 7 weeks of rioting in the Gaza Strip, orchestrated by Hamas, culminated in the deadliest day in Gaza since 2014. And now, a draft resolution has been circulated in the UN Security Council to punish not Hamas for their terror and murderous violence, but Israel for defending itself against this terrorist group. To talk about this, we'll go once again to our Jerusalem Bureau and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, we talked at length about this on Wednesday's program, so I'm not going to recap the Trumpet's position necessarily on this violence and who's at fault and all of that. But I do want to focus on one part of the what's coming before the Security Council. If you've been watching the Trumpet or listening to the Trumpet daily, you would have heard a lot of Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, speaking quite a lot, giving some powerful comments on how wondering why the world is focusing again on Israel just after these 60 deaths, when 50 of the people, according to Hamas, are Hamas members that were killed on Monday. But there's one part of this resolution that was put forward by Kuwait. Kuwait is the Arab representative on the Security Council, one of the rotating members on the Security Council. And they put an interesting resolution forward that is calling for an international peacekeeping force to be instilled on the Gaza border between Israel and Gaza, and to maintain peace and to protect the Palestinians from the big bad Israelis. Now, this is, I don't think this is necessarily going to pass. The United States have said that they're going to veto it or shoot it down, and they've got a veto on as one of the permanent members of the Security Council. But nevertheless, it does indicate something that the world is going to start calling for more and more. I don't want to draw necessarily too much attention to this because I don't think it will pass, but I do want to draw attention briefly to the prophetic significance of a call for international peacekeepers protecting or maintaining these borders between Israel and the Palestinians, because this is something that we look at as being significant prophetically. The Bible indicates that in the future, there is going to be a call, perhaps from the Israelis even, or at least welcomed by the Israelis, for somebody to come in and keep the peace between the Palestinians and Israel. And people can read up about this this future event in our article entitled "The Counterfeit Peacemaker." It was written back in 2001, yet it's extremely valid for our time. And so, just the Kuwaitis coming to say, "Let's get somebody else in there to maintain peace," I think is biblically significant, and it's the call for that should be watched for if people are looking at the events in the Middle East in terms of Bible prophecy.
We'll be sure to have a link to the counterfeit peacemaker in the show notes. Jerusalem really is the trigger that ignites World War III. We know that from Bible prophecy, so it's always vital to keep a close eye on that. We really appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that, Brent. Last week, we spoke a little bit about a new government that's formed in Italy that is Eurosceptic, and just how that could work to weaken the foundations of the European Union. And it turns out that Germany, the lead nation in the EU, which has benefited so much from its creation and its common currency, is really displeased with this new Italian government. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Well, we're not quite there yet with the government. They're expecting to get their coalition together over the weekend. And because Italy's constitution is arguably the most dysfunctional in the world, it's got to be approved by their president and he might block it. So there's still some uncertainty there.
Okay.
But this week, the coalition documents that they're working on leaked. Actually, they leaked a few times this week. But the big leak that got Germany pretty upset was on Monday. It leaked that their policy was to tell the European Central Bank that they were not going to pay back 250 billion euros worth of debt. And that's what got some in Germany pretty apoplectic. Mm-hmm. The European Central Bank has basically been printing money, using that money to buy up government bonds. And the only reason Germany is even a tiny bit okay with a central bank printing money and buying government bonds is that the European Central Bank has promised to, that it will have to undo that at some point in the future. All of that will have to be repaid. Italy is basically saying, nope, we just want the European Central Bank to print money now, going on indefinitely to fund us. This was what got the Alternative for Deutschland started in the first place, was the euro and people being worried about the euro, worried about Germany's economy. And they're furious about this. Professor Hans-Werner Sinn, who's a fairly famous economist at the Munich University, he was talking about some of the problems that are developing now. And he said there's no possible solution to this. The catastrophe is happening. This is going to lead to the destruction of Europe, to say it bluntly. It will also bring the AfD to power in Germany. So, people are talking about radical changes in Europe, radical changes in Germany because of what's happening. Now, the coalition partners have walked back on that demand. They say it's not in our current coalition. They said that was just an early draft. But the cat's out of the bag that they are thinking of refusing to pay debt back. So obviously when Germany is thinking about putting in anything that involves them loaning money to Italy, yeah, and they know that the government's toying with not paying that back, that is going to affect their decisions. And there's still plenty in this, what this potential government's talking about that they do not like. They're basically talking about just completely ignoring all of Europe's limits on spending. We've said before, the euro, it's a little bit like a shared credit card. And so Italy now going around saying we're just going to borrow money for universal basic income and whatever kind of thing that we like. Again, Germany is less than thrilled about that. But so again, you can see that this is building to a showdown. Now, just like what we talked about earlier with Germany and Iran, you know, we can see there's problems building in the long term. What will happen in the short term still remains to be seen. You know, we still don't know. The president could decide that this government is too radical and block it, which could then lead to a bit of a constitutional crisis because it looks like the voters would just put it back in power again. And you know, what happens at that point? You've also got questions about, you know, just how quickly this will play out. Some economists are saying, well, actually, they're borrowing tons of money, could work out great for the Italian economy and solve a lot of their problems in the short term. But then, of course, be storing up massive problems for when the next economic downturn hits. So maybe we're not going to see any fallout from this until there's some kind of global economic problem. And this is just actually just, you know, kind of putting more explosives into that ticking time bomb that's sitting in Europe that we're going to have to deal with at some point, but not yet. So again, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out in the short term. But in the longer run, there is some big problems brewing here. I talked about this. We have an article on this in our latest Trumpet print edition. Not the one that's about to go to print, but the one that's been out for a month or so. Italy, game over for traditional politics, talking about these trends. And you know, that can really help go through exactly why we're watching this. Mr. Armstrong talked about Europe uniting. He talked about those prophecies that we mentioned in the first half about 10 nations getting together. But he was also very clear that this would not be an easy process. You know, he talked about how hard it had been already for them to unite, how hard it was going to continue to be. And he talked about it will need a crisis to get it to come together. And when it does, when that crisis hits, they'll come together really quickly. Even Europeans' founding father, Jean Monnet, he talked about Europe will be forged in crisis and will be the sum of the solutions adopted for those crises. Trumpet editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, he talked about the same thing. One of the big prophecies we're watching in Europe is for it to be led by a religious power. And Mr. Flurry talked about it. He said, well, usually these two, the church and state, have been drawn together because of a crisis, because of an emergency. Herbert W. Armstrong believed the same pattern would occur in our time, that European nations would unite suddenly because of a crisis, that the Roman Catholic Church would play a huge role in solving that emergency. In times of crisis, religions have a way of pulling people together. Crises are developing that could lead to this emergency that will cause Europe to look to a newly strengthened Germany and end up bringing church and state together, from the weakening of the U.S. economy to danger brewing in the Middle East. So what we're seeing in Italy is just contributing to that growing crisis that will provide the pressure necessary for Europe to unite in that 10-nation superpower prophesied in the Bible.
And we'll be sure to have a link to Richard's very powerful article, Italy, Game Over for Traditional Politics, in the show notes. Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Richard. All of the stories that we're discussing today, or just about all of them, are published on thetrumpet.com. Please feel free to visit there and subscribe to our print edition and also our free email news briefs that we send out several times a week. Well, China's first domestically developed aircraft carrier has just begun sea trials. And it was just a few short years ago that China had no aircraft carriers at all, but now they're just a short time away from having two in service. To tell us about this and about what it means for the increasingly prominent role that we've seen China's Navy take in recent years, we'll go to Callum Wood.
That's right. China's first domestically developed aircraft carrier left its northeastern port to begin sea trials on Sunday. Now, this is, as you mentioned, the second aircraft carrier that's going to come into China's possession. The first one was purchased secondhand from Ukraine in 1998 It was originally bought to be used as a casino, a floating casino. But when it reached China, the government in Beijing, well, they had different ideas, and they refitted it and they turned it into a fully functioning aircraft carrier. This new aircraft carrier now, we wrote about this and spoke about it last year when it was first put to water. Since that time, it hasn't left the ports. It's sat there and been fitted out with the latest in weapons technology and other equipment. And now it's going out for these sea trials. This new aircraft carrier, it's going to carry China's Shenyang J-15 fighter jets. Now, these aren't the latest state-of-the-art fighter jets, and certainly the aircraft carrier is a lot smaller than aircraft carriers that we see coming out of the United States, but it does serve a very important purpose. And the size of the aircraft carrier does actually speak to China's goals, and it's the reason for having these aircraft carriers. Now, the Chinese, they've spoken about having up to 6 aircraft carriers. This latest one that's just now going to sea for trials, they expect it to be fully operational by 2020. But for now, it's going out for these sea trials. But the thing we have to remember is China isn't trying to develop a global police force with its aircraft carriers.
Right.
The United States, they have nuclear aircraft carriers. They can travel around the world for months on months on months and deploy to the Middle East, and they can stay there for a really long time. China's aircraft carriers are a lot smaller. They can only release smaller aircraft. They could never release American aircraft. They're just too big, too heavy, especially when they're fully laden with munitions. But what they can do is project power into the near region, and that is exactly where China's focus is at the moment. Across the South China Sea, we see the Chinese arming, we see them developing their military capabilities, their supply lines through the String of Pearls and the like. China's projecting a lot of power into the region, and nothing says power like an aircraft carrier. China might have its hypersonic missiles, its incredible missile capabilities, its satellite technology, but when you see an aircraft carrier sail past your homeland, that might put a bit more fear in you. And certainly the likes of Taiwan and the other nations that are fighting over these disputed Spratly Islands and the other islands that China's been developing, now that there's a second aircraft carrier on the scene, well, that's sending a real message to those nations in the region.
So do you think that this could pose a threat to the United States and America's naval dominance in the region? We know that it couldn't really threaten America's global dominance, but in the region there, in the South China Sea in particular, is America's ability to safeguard those shipping lanes, is that threatened?
Absolutely. Each year, about $5.3 trillion worth of trade passes through the South China Sea. And as we've seen, China's been really developing that, militarizing it. Having an aircraft carrier in the region projects China's power so much further. We know that America does have some forward bases in the region, in Guam especially. That could certainly be put on higher alert if a Chinese aircraft carrier was in the region. China wouldn't need to deploy halfway around the world to reach Guam. It's just across the pond, you might say. Yeah. So it's definitely a threat to America. We've heard a lot today about trade and the implications of prophecy and trade. We've heard, especially just now, about Ezekiel and trade wars, and we've heard about besiegement. Now, we could go to those scriptures in Ezekiel 4 and elsewhere, which talk about this besiegement on the house of Israel, which is, of course, we know, not talking just about the Jews, but the modern descendants of Israel, specifically the United States and Britain. And so when you think about how much trade is flowing through the South China Sea on a daily, on a yearly basis, now we know that not all of that is, of course, going to America, but China's ability to disrupt trade, to disrupt and upend the order of things, the economy of the world, well, their ability only grows stronger with the arrival of this latest aircraft carrier. So certainly this can be very detrimental to the United States, not only militarily in the region, but the American way of life, even the West, Australia, England. We all have economies. We all rely on this region in one way or another for the stability of the world. And China's ability to disrupt that, to project its power further and further and further with the likes of these aircraft carriers, is incredibly important.
Where would you direct listeners who'd like to know more about this in the context of Bible prophecy?
We have a great article from the July 2016 Trumpet print edition. It's by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry. It's called China is Steering the World Towards War.
We'll be sure to include a link to that in our show notes. Thanks very much for that, Callum. Well, any of our listeners who lived through the Watergate scandal know just what a momentous event that was in United States history. And even those of us who didn't live through that chapter of history were probably taught quite a lot about it in history classes, just because it was such a major event. But now it looks like a new scandal that is emerging at this moment in American history is even more momentous. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
President Trump announced yesterday via Twitter that word seems to be coming out that the Obama FBI spied on the Trump campaign with an embedded informant. And now here on the Trumpet Hour, we've been covering this for some time about the Obama administration's FBI using an unverified report of Russian propaganda from a former British intelligence officer to possibly illegally get a warrant to wiretap the Trump campaign. But now they're starting to look at the possibility that they actually had an FBI informant working in the Trump campaign.
Wow.
Information still coming out, but Congress has subpoenaed the records to try to get more information on that. And because the company that paid Christopher Steele to put together this dossier of Russian rumors on President Trump, the CEO of that company had said that he had a human source in the Trump campaign, and then kind of tried to backtrack what he said when he realized how explosive that revelation was. And now the Congress, they're trying to subpoena the information, and the Justice Department's refusing to declassify those documents, saying that it would hurt American foreign relations and possibly jeopardize lives, which shows that not only did they just admit that there was a source in the Trump campaign, if it's going to hurt foreign relations, I figured that that source may not be an American citizen either. And so I'm sure there'll be more information coming out in the coming weeks as to exactly how deep that source went, or whether the Obama administration actually did hire a foreign spy to work for President Trump's presidential campaign. Like the president said, if that's true, it's definitely bigger than Watergate. But in the meantime, the next edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet, which I believe went to print today, has two cover stories on the unfolding efforts of the Obama administration to spy on the Trump campaign and the U.S. government's war on itself, that will put all this into a much deeper prophetic context for our Trumpet subscribers.
So do you think if this is confirmed that it could eventually lead to any sort of legal consequences for anyone in the Obama administration?
If it's confirmed, it's definitely illegal. Now, prosecuting a former president or key officials for a former president is difficult in the current political environment America's in right now, just because their nation's pretty well evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. And so you're almost getting towards more of a situation like you've seen in Latin America over the past century, where people are more loyal to political parties than to the country, and trying to prosecute a key official from the other political party can get messy.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. We won't be able to link to those two stories that he mentioned in our print edition because they're not online just yet, but we'll have them up there hopefully in the next week or so. So please stop back in at thetrumpet.com just to learn the latest about these really, really important developments. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Please visit us at thetrumpet.com to learn more about the stories we're discussing and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief that we send out several times each week. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Callum Wood, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with some words from Henry David Thoreau. What's the use of a fine house if you haven't got a tolerable planet to put it on? Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.